My name is Eric Larson. I'm here to welcome and to introduce Eyal Rosenberg, who is an anarchist PhD student from Haifa, is how he identifies himself. And he's going to be talking on essentially the interplay between ethnicity and class in the formation of Israeli society. What that means is the relationship between the Zionist establishment and the two oppressed ethnic groups or disadvantaged ethnic groups, namely the Palestinians and the Mizrahi Jews in Israel. Eyal has worked with Green Course, which is a student green organization in Israel. He was a draftee into the Israeli army, which lasted 2 years before he quit, but that's another story. And he's also worked with New Profile, which is a new organization supporting conscientious objectors and avoiders of the draft in Israel. But the topic that he's talking on today is a little more general, and it has to do with the substance of Israeli society and how it got that way. So we're going to be hearing from him, and there will be time for questions during the course of his talk. So please welcome Eyal Rosenberg.
So I want to start with very rough and technical data, just to give us a sort of background. So, okay, this is a very rough map of Palestine, which is a part of the Middle East. So this is like the Mediterranean Sea. And the main cities, at least as they are today, are Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Haifa. And we'll get back to geography a little later in the talk. And the other kind of data that I want to throw at you is a bit of demographics, because this is going to be a very important aspect of the talk and the formation of Israeli society and then the policies of the State of Israel over time. So we begin around 1900. We have Palestinians. Of them, some are Muslim and some are Christian. And actually some are Jews, but I'll mention that in a while. And in this column we'll have Jews, colonists, slash immigrants. And we're going to divide them into two groups, which are Ashkenazi and Mizrahi. Before actually giving you any data, I want to talk about what these two terms signify. Ashkenazi Jews are Jews mostly from Eastern Europe, meaning Poland, Russia, Germany, Austria. That's the basic area that's identified with the Ashkenazis. And the Mizrahi Jews are the Jews originally, if you look, say, 200 or 300 years back, that were living in North Africa, from Morocco to Egypt, and in the Middle East, in the various Arab countries, including the minority of Jews who were living in Palestine before Zionism started. Now, of course, there are more countries in the world, and if you're a Jew and you arrive in Israel today, or even any time within the last 50 years, you're sort of identified with one of these groups, but I don't want to talk about what Russians constitute on the Ashkenazi-Mizrahi spectrum, or immigrants from other countries. So anyway, our story, at least our demographic story, begins in 1900, when we have about 600,000 Palestinians, and a large majority of them is Muslim, a sizable minority are Christians, and there are also minor ethnic groups within Palestine, including the Jews, small numbers of them, some Druze, Bedouin, who are also Muslim, but are somewhat distinct, and others. Now, at this point, we have the small number, I don't remember the percentages, and I specifically didn't want, you know, to memorize exact numbers for this talk, because the important thing is the overall trend. So we have a small number of Jews who will be identified eventually as Mizrahi, but at this point they're just, you know, Palestinian Jews. And I guess you could even say that they're part of this group. And Zionist immigration into Palestine began in the late 19th century. So we already have a small number of Ashkenazi Jews, because immigration was initially almost strictly from the East European countries within Palestine, that are beginning to form what will be called the Yeshuv, or the settlement, or the colony. If we skip forward to 1948, the number of natives has increased to 1.2 million, and the number of colonists is now around 600,000. And this is on the eve of the war of 1948 and the Palestinian catastrophe, which is called in Arabic the Nakba. So after the Nakba, this is still 1948 or 1949. We're not talking about all of Palestine, since now it's Israel, because what happened in 1947 and during the war is that Palestine got split into two areas. The larger one controlled by the Jewish state, and the rest of Palestine was controlled by the Jordanians and by the Egyptians. And in the area that was controlled by Israel, we have a number of Palestinians which is about 170,000. And the number of Jews is about the same because there has still not been significant immigration. We're not counting what happened right after the war. So there's a war, and a very large number of Palestinian natives are displaced, and most of them are driven off what will be the State of Israel into refugee camps, some of them in the territories that are now controlled by Jordan and Egypt, some into Lebanon, which is to the north, and Syria, which is to the northeast, Jordan and Egypt. At this point, almost all of the Jewish colonists in what is now the State of Israel are Ashkenazi Jews. But, and I'll get to the reason for this later, this is about to change. And over the next 30 years or so by, say, 1970, and now I won't mention numbers anymore, we'll talk about percentages. The percentage of Palestinians remains sort of stable throughout the existence of Israel at about 20%. Again, this is not counting all of the refugees outside and the people in the territories, but the Ashkenazis become a minority. So we have more than 50% Mizrahi Jews and less than 50% Ashkenazis. And the way this has happened is that after the state was formed and by 1970, there are huge waves of immigration of Jews from North Africa and the Arab countries into Israel. I'm not going to talk about the recent several decades and about the Russian immigration in the 1990s. We're talking about these more formative years. So after giving the dry details of what the demographics look like, I want to talk a bit about the Zionist movement and how it came to exist and why these demographics are very important to it. If we think about European Jewry in the 19th century, it is living through a very tumultuous time, to say the least, and it is faced with all sorts of challenges and problems, and of course the problem of anti-Semitism, of discrimination, and often even violence, economic, physical, legislative, if I can use that term, against them in many countries and by many states, is becoming an increasing problem. And in the late 1800s, there is a number of significant attacks against Jews in the areas of Tsarist Russia called pogroms. And this situation, and in general, the position of Jews within European society, prompted all sorts of possible strategies or responses, if you will. One would be to try to integrate into the emerging European democracies on the basis of citizenship and of liberalism. For Jews to become citizens like any other and on the basis of equal rights for all citizens, equal opportunities, etc., to be fully integrated into the societies in which they live. Another course of action was to adopt a socialist perspective or anarchist perspective, which means that you support radical social change in the structure, both political and economic, of the European societies. And as part of that change, you would expect racism to be resolved or go away, or at least become significantly less of a problem, so that will allow you as a Jew or as a Jewish community to live among the non-Jews or the Gentiles. And the third solution, which is the solution which led to the formation of the State of Israel eventually, is to immigrate. But even within immigration, you have two options. You can immigrate either to Western Europe or to the US, where anti-Semitism is not as bad, and there are better economic prospects. And the other option is to consider mass immigration of Jews only, to form a strictly Jewish community somewhere in the world, initially it was not clear that this was going to be the ancient land of Israel. Other options were also considered. So we mentioned three options, including the immigration option, and within it the option of forming a separate community, or national community even, because even then it was stated or thought upon in the terms of nation building. This option of immigration to some country in which a Jewish state or nation will be constituted was very much a minority among East European Jews. The majority strategies among those that I mentioned are immigrating to the West, and indeed we see millions of Jews in the US today as a result of that immigration, and adopting socialist perspective and joining socialist parties or organizations, being active in the labor movements. And Jews were very active in East European, and I guess also West European to a lesser extent, socialism and anarchism in the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. But even though the strand of thought or the position of trying to form a national Jewish community as a solution to the problem of Jews in Europe, although it was a minority position, the people or the social strata which held it were the ones that were closer to European governments, to the Tsarist state, to the Polish state, to governments in Western Europe. And they rode the tide of European colonialism in general. And this sort of allowed them eventually to get the British Empire to recognize a right of the Jews to form a national home, to use a quote from someone called Balfour, whom you've never heard of, and to begin colonial activities in Palestine. Now, I'm sort of glossing over some details here because actually, like I said, colonialist activity by the Zionist movement began before the British occupied Palestine, which was in 1917. But this is an important watershed date because after that, immigration began in earnest. And you can see that if in 1900 you had a very small number of colonists, then over the decades from 1917 to 1948, their number increased significantly. And like I said, these were Ashkenazi Jews. Unfortunately for the Zionist movement, it was faced with two important demographic problems. The first problem was that due to the Holocaust, the Second World War, the reservoir for Jewish immigration into Palestine was pretty much depleted. The other problem was that there was another people, the Palestinian people, living in this country and occupying a lot of the land and working it. And true, the Palestinians were not a powerful nation. They were relatively pre-industrialized. I won't talk about the relations of production in Ottoman Palestine. That's also a very fascinating subject because although it wasn't capitalism, it also wasn't feudalism, but a different system. Anyway, they pose a problem demographically because if you're a national movement, regardless of whether you're also a colonial project or not, and you want to form a national state, then since capitalism and bourgeois democracy are what's in vogue at the moment, that's what you want for yourself. But you have a problem. If you were to have a democratic state in Palestine, then the majority of the population would be the natives. So you have to work out a way to avoid this problem. The strategy is twofold. First of all, bring more Jews from Europe or elsewhere to offset the number of Palestinians. And the other strategy is the strategy of dispossession, which is what was carried out in the War of 1948. Now, how does this look from a class perspective? From a class perspective, like I said, the Zionist movement was mostly composed of people. Not a lot of them were in the large capitalist bourgeoisie initially. That only happened over time, involvement of significant capital in the Zionist project. Initially, people like Herzl and others were people of the free trades, like academics, journalists, and other would be called petit bourgeois. Of course, once they got an increasing number of people to immigrate, then you also had some part of the Ashkenazi Jewry who were working class or who were forced into becoming working class upon immigrating into a new country. But predominantly, the use of labor within the colonial project was from the beginning based on the existence of an ethnic underclass. Initially, these were the Palestinians. As early as 1900 and before that, the way a lot of the colonial project was carried out is the creation of agricultural mini-colonies, or even, I would say, plantation-style communities in which Palestinians would do most of the agricultural, or almost entirely agricultural work. And it was managed by Jewish colonists, who sometimes also did part of the work themselves, mostly the work of management, technical work, etc. In this context, I want to read a quote which ties in the question of the Mizrahi Jews. So this is a quote from a newspaper that came out in Palestine, a Jewish newspaper called Hatzvi, which is the deer. "This is the simple, natural worker who is capable of any manner of labor, without shame, without philosophy, and without poetry. And Mr. Marx is certainly not present in his pocket nor in his mind. I do not mean to say that the Yemenite element must remain in its current state of wild barbarism. Today's Yemenites still stand on the same low level of the Arab peasants. In their physical constitution and working stills, they cannot even match the Arab peasants. But there is no doubt that the Yemenite workers, who will not await monies from their home in Yemen, and who are very poor, will be forced, unless they are found a comfortable means of fundraising, and if our activists will stand firm their guard on this matter, they will be forced to take hold of the shovel, the plow, and the horse's reins. Their bodies shall strengthen, they shall gain experience with the work and its conditions, and will then be the best competitors in all manners of farm work. They will come and take, as indeed they can take, the place of the Arabs." And the Yemenites that this article is referring to is a small group of, I think, a few thousand Jews who immigrated from Yemen to Palestine in the early 1900s, which was, like I said, not the majority of the immigration. Most of it had come from Eastern Europe. But this early group of Yemenites were very terribly exploited, and some died in horrid circumstances, which I won't go into, but their conditions were pretty terrible. And this was sort of like a premonition or a telling sign of what was to come. The Ashkenazi part of the Shuv, or at least the part of it which wasn't actually working class, started to organize itself in what would eventually be the institutions of the Israeli state. And that means political institutions, which I won't go into a lot, and political parties, which were theoretically socialist, at least the majority of them, and the most important one, which was Mapai, the Workers' Party of the Land of Israel. And they also formed a labor union federation called the Histadrut, which included predominantly Ashkenazis. Mizrahis were a very small fraction of the population at that time, so that doesn't really matter. But what does matter is that the Histadrut excluded Palestinian workers completely, and also campaigned and sometimes even went on strikes for the purity of the employment of Jews in industry and agriculture, at least when it comes to Jewish employers. That's as far as the population, and like I mentioned earlier, over time there was also more and more involvement of foreign capital in this colonial project, mostly rich Jews from Europe and from the US, but there were also the interests of the British, who were very interested in Israel, both as a source for some agricultural products like olives and citrus fruit, but especially in the context of oil. Somewhere over here you have Iraq, and there's actually a pipeline which goes from Iraq all the way to Haifa, and the British built refineries there. And the pipe, I think it functioned until about 1948, after Israel was formed, the oil stopped running for some reason. But this was a very important consideration for the British in controlling Palestine. There were other geopolitical considerations which I won't go into. So we have, let's call it Jewish Zionist capital, and we have British capital, which gradually plays less of a role, and especially after the mandate is over and Israel is formed, then it's the capitalist class, which is practically all Zionist. There were some small-scale Palestinian capitalists in budding Palestinian capitalism before the Zionist project began. For example, people who owned citrus fruit orchards and began to employ workers outside of the pseudo-feudal mode of production that prevailed then. What I want to talk about now is the other part of the strategy of the Zionist Yishuv with respect to the demographic problem. After the war of 1948, apparently you might think the problem was solved because you had a huge decrease of the number of Palestinian and a solid Jewish majority. Unfortunately, the rate of reproduction among Palestinians is much higher than among Jews. So this had to be balanced off by more immigration, and there were no more Jews left in Europe, basically. So Jews began to be brought in from the Arab countries. Now, I already illustrated with that quote the sort of attitude culturally that the Zionist establishment, and in fact most of the Ashkenazi population, had towards the Arab Jews or the Jews from Morocco. They considered them to be inferior in practically any sense. I wouldn't say subhuman, but certainly not capable of the same level of mental achievements and not entitled to the same social benefits as Ashkenazi Jews. I want to go over several of the ways in which the establishment in the State of Israel, meaning the political parties, the state institutions, the labor union federation, and to some extent also private capital, although it wasn't that active in this respect, the ways in which they made sure that the immigrant population, which class-wise was rather diverse and included many people with high education, sometimes even some academics, small-time capitalists, store owners, people who had owned real estate, etc., all to be bunched in almost entirely into the lower strata of the working class, and indeed, like the quote that I mentioned said, taking to some extent the place of the Palestinians. One of the most important aspects was the geographic aspect. Mizrahis were assigned mostly to live either in peripheral areas or peripheral towns. Like, for example, this is how the town of Be'er Sheva got started, and, well, Kiryat Shmona, which is about here, and other small settlements in the border areas. And also in the cities, they were mostly relegated to neighborhoods which were either more poorly constructed or which got a worse level of public services. And sometimes they were even housed in neighborhoods which had been abandoned by Palestinians as they were fleeing Palestine during the war of 1948. And this was the case in both near Tel Aviv, in neighborhoods of Arabic Jaffa, and in Haifa, in a very important neighborhood called Wadi Salib, which also saw a Mizrahi uprising, urban uprising in 1959. They were separated geographically. This wasn't complete segregation, of course, and I'll go later into the way Palestinians were treated, and we'll see a lot of parallelisms between the treatment of Mizrahis and the treatment of Palestinians, but still, the geographic difference was an important part of the basis. Another important aspect I already mentioned is government and public services, both in education and healthcare. And municipal services, the quality of service that Mizrahis and Mizrahi neighborhoods or settlements which were predominantly Mizrahi got was significantly lower than that of the Ashkenazis. It's especially interesting to look at what happened in the education system. In the education system, the sort of prejudice which I illustrated before was very prevalent among the high-ranking people who were designing the curricula and the school system. And the educational system was constructed so as to divert Mizrahi students into occupations which have more to do with menial labor rather than, call it, mental work, technically skilled work, academia, etc. Many of them studied for less years than their Ashkenazi counterparts. So if an Ashkenazi high school student would get the full 12 years, Mizrahi's education often ended after 8 or 9. And of course, the quality of the infrastructure, the size of the classes, the amount of budget allocated to hiring teachers and developing materials for the Mizrahi section, if I can call it that, of the education system was much below that for the Ashkenazis. And this results in a sort of absurdity in which the average level of education of the first generation of immigrants, of the Mizrahi immigrants, is higher than that of the second generation. Like I mentioned, in the origin countries, many of them were very well educated, or at least a higher percentage than Ashkenazi immigrants from Eastern Europe and Russia. Another aspect of the policy of, shall we call it, class shaping of the Mizrahis has to do with employment. If you're a Mizrahi and you've been assigned to live in a relatively peripheral settlement, there are very few opportunities for employment. This has two important effects. One of them is the one company or two company town, like you might hear about here in the US, where you would have a town of only miners who work for a certain company. In Israel, there's a relatively large town called Dimona, in which a very large percentage of the people work for a very small number of firms. One of them is a chemical industry, which processes material and mine from the Dead Sea. And, well, I won't go into all of the specifics, but the point is that if you get on the bad side of your employers in one of these companies, then your chance of finding alternative employment is very low. Another issue with the employment of Mizrahi immigrants was that in some areas you had a settlement which was Ashkenazi, and around it several settlements, or it can be just one or two, which were Mizrahi. And the nature of these agricultural settlements, or mostly agricultural settlements, differed considerably. The predominantly Ashkenazi settlements usually got to control much larger amounts of land, and the land that they got was leased for prolonged periods of time and under better conditions, while Mizrahi settlements often got no land and were not intended to control land or to be agricultural, but to be towns in which workers would stay and would go work in agriculture or in light industry centered in Ashkenazi settlements. If you've heard about the concept of the kibbutz, it was very often the case that a kibbutz would have certain light industries or agricultural enterprises, and since they would require a lot more people working than the people in the kibbutz, they would hire workers from the surrounding area, and again, very often, these workers were Mizrahi. And the Mizrahis were not equal members who shared in the socialist utopia of the kibbutz. On the contrary, they got relatively low wage and certainly did not participate in ownership or management or division of profits. A fourth aspect of the oppression of Mizrahis has to do with the question of organization, both political, community, and otherwise. Jewish communities in the Arab countries did have various forms of community and sometimes even national level organization. It's difficult to describe the process exactly, but effectively, these were not able to survive the transition to Palestine for various reasons. One of the important reasons is that there was selection in immigration. The Israeli authorities preferred to have individuals immigrate as such rather than whole communities, and they, of course, preferred people who were more physically able and have less of a burden of a larger family to support, and especially like elderly parents, etc. So that broke up a lot of the social structure of the communities which were immigrating into Israel. Also, attempts to form independent Mizrahi organizations in all sorts of domains were met with resistance from the establishment. And this resistance was manifold. First, there was usually an attempt to integrate Mizrahi activists or Mizrahi organizations within the existing organizational framework of the Labor Union Federation, which also had a host of social activities it was involved in. But like I said, it was part of the system of repression of Mizrahis. And another thing that was done often is more, shall we say, assertive resistance and sometimes even violence against Mizrahi activists and Mizrahi organizations, sometimes as far, going as far as framing up activists with trumped up charges and their placement in jail. And often it was the case that the strategy was to try to co-opt a group of individuals who were being more active, and if they were found to be uncooptable, to act against them and to try to suppress the organization. Another thing that would happen sometimes is that you had like two competing organizations. Like you could have a community organization of, say, Jews from a certain country, say Iraqis in some neighborhood. Then the Histadrut or the Mapai party would open like a youth club and would start funding it very well and attracting people to it. And after their independent competitor would get into trouble and not find enough support, funding would kind of die out. And of course, it's needless to mention that relations between Mizrahis and either Palestinians or Arabs from other countries were not only discouraged, but to this day, most of these kinds of relations, especially if they have any hint of politics, are usually considered to be illegal, and you could get into a lot of trouble, if not prolonged jail sentences, for this sort of activity. And this gets me into the fifth and final aspect of oppression, which is the de-Arabization, or the turning of the Mizrahis as part of the Israelis in general against the Palestinians and against Arab civilization and the Arab neighbors of Israel as a whole. The concept of us being a small state surrounding by enemies who want to destroy us, who are uncivilized, who are evil, who resist, who reject our superior and better way of life, and I might end up even quoting some Bush speeches about Islam, is very significant in the socialization of Israelis from childhood. And this has double the strength considering the Holocaust. Although this was not really true for most Mizrahis who did not experience it, the perception that our physical existence is always threatened and there might be mass killing of Jews again, this time by the Muslims or the Arabs, is another very important element in socialization of individuals in Israeli society. It's an important element in the education system. And of course you have military service, which is another powerful socializing agent. And it's also been, for many years, sort of an entry card into mainstream Israeli society for a population like the Mizrahis who have been suspect. And why are they suspect? Because in essence, most of them are Arabic. They're Arab Jews. Their original language is Arabic. They come from Arab countries. Their culture is Arabic culture originally, or Arabic Jewish culture, but still. And you sort of have to go through a purification by turning against your Arab past, the Arab language of your parents, the countries that you are originally from. You serve in the military and your experience is the experience of fighting Arabs, or at least preparing for the sort of a fight. And this sinks in. And for an Ashkenazi, this is mostly just xenophobia. But for Mizrahis, it's also a form of self-denial or self-hate even. And this is also a very powerful agent of oppression. At this point, I would like to have questions from you. And the second part, I want to discuss what happened to the Palestinians after Israel was formed in all these aspects that I mentioned and some others, and to draw parallels between the Palestinians and the Mizrahis and their treatment.
Part of the Israeli narrative of 1948 and the years just succeeding that is that the Mizrahi Jews came to Israel because they were kicked out by Arab countries, that there was a mass expulsion of hundreds of thousands, and that's how they came to be in Israel. So it kind of sets up a sort of a grievance for that group. Now, to what extent is that narrative correct, and to what extent is it not correct? Because you seem to be implying that there's something that the Mizrahi are being told to forget or not to believe about themselves.
I want to gather some more questions before I answer everything.
Anybody else?
Well, it's not a question. I think the most important attribute of the Jewish population in Israel, the most significant way to describe it, is with three words: extreme maniacal nationalism. End of comment.
Well, just quickly to say, it's very interesting what you say about the socialization and the education, but I have also heard that Israeli Jews are often more, there is a more radical element than there is among American Jewry.
Do the Mizrahi still speak Arabic in general, or have they already forgotten the language they used to speak?
Okay, then I want to begin from the question that's easiest to answer, which is the last question about the use of Arabic. First of all, two of the most sizable group of Mizrahi Jews are actually Moroccan Jews, whose original language is Moroccan, which is related to Arabic but not Arabic. And also the Yemenites speak a language which is similar to Arabic but not the same language. So the question is really, do they still speak their languages of origin? And the answer is that some do, but these numbers have decreased considerably. And I think actually that a large majority, I don't know to estimate exactly in percentage, a large majority of Mizrahis today don't speak Arabic or the original language. About Eric's question, this is not just a point, it's a subject for an entire different talk, of the question of to what extent Mizrahi immigration to Israel was voluntary and to what extent it was coerced. First of all, there are differences between countries. There are countries, or states rather, in which the immigration was predominantly voluntary, like in Morocco, but it was voluntary after a lot of efforts of convincing and a lot of promises made by, you could call them recruitment campaigns of Israel among Jewish communities in Morocco and other countries. There were countries in which there was actual expulsion. I'm not sure exactly in which of them there was technical expulsion. It could have been Syria, but don't take me by the word. But this was a minority. Another large percentage of Mizrahi Jews come from Iraq, and that's a very interesting story because Iraqi Jewry was mostly opposed to Zionism and didn't really want to leave Iraq. But in beginning of the 1940s, and especially after Israel was formed and after it became clear that it was going to be pretty aggressive in its relations to the Arab states, the divide between Jews and Muslims and Christians and other Arabs in Arabic countries and also in Egypt increased. And there was also some collusion between Israel and Arabic regimes to get Jews to immigrate, to encourage them either positively or negatively in all sorts of ways, some pretty seedy, to leave the country and to immigrate to Israel. So the answer is not clear-cut. To answer your question about the radical strands among Jews in general and in Israel, they certainly do exist, and they exist also both among Ashkenazis and among Mizrahis. Unfortunately, radicalism, as we've often seen, can be co-opted and can be made to serve intentions and interests which are sometimes even contradictory to what the initial radical instinct of individuals or groups would lead them to. So socialism among Jews was used extensively by the dominant party in the first couple of decades of Israeli existence, and before that, the Workers' Party of the Land of Israel. It used a lot of socialist rhetoric. It referred to or described its own actions and the project of the formation of Israel as a socialist project, as a formation of a workers' society. Now, in retrospect, this might seem like a joke, but if you think about what statist socialism has meant, say, in the Eastern Bloc, things are not entirely different from government policies you might have seen in Russia or Romania or, well, I don't know about Poland at all, but I'm a quarter Romanian, so I know a little more about that. As for radicalism among the Mizrahis, before I turn to talk about the Palestinians, I do want to mention two forms of struggle which have failed resoundingly over the years to improve the conditions of Mizrahis in Israel. The first one is the striving towards the achievement of proportional representation in institutions and in political parties and even within the capitalist class. Of course, I'm skipping over many decades which I have not described at all, the processes that have taken place in them, but in today's Israel, you have had Mizrahis as the heads of the military, ministers of defense, minister of finance, not yet a Mizrahi prime minister, but this could very well happen sometime in the near future. Mizrahis among the capitalists, Mizrahis in academia, of course, not proportionally to their percentage in the population, but still, they are now present, and those Mizrahis who rose to prominence have been at best as bad as any Ashkenazis in rectifying historical wrongs and certainly class-wise towards the working class in general. And especially also in foreign policy. Just think of the last war in Lebanon in which you had the Minister of Defense being a Moroccan Jew from Sderot called Amir Peretz. And he had no qualms about bombing Lebanon back to the Stone Age, so much for intra-ethnic solidarity of the oppressed. Another form of Mizrahi struggle, which has also failed resoundingly, is the attempt to form Mizrahi political parties. Well, the claim that this has failed resoundingly is a claim that I'm making, and many might not agree with me. But there have been attempts to form independent Mizrahi parties. They have mostly failed to get enough votes in the elections to enter parliament. Or if they did enter, they only lasted for like one term. And the only electorally successful Mizrahi party is a party called Shas, which is a religious party. You could say it's semi-fundamentalist. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. But overall, if you look at its effect, and the benefits, or lack of them, which have accrued to Mizrahis from its existence and its being in coalition governments, they are very, very few. So these are two strategies which have failed. And now for the second part of the talk, I want to talk about the part of the population which I left off the discussion about in 1948, the Palestinians. So I'm not talking at all about the refugees or the people in the 1967 occupied territories. I'm only talking about the group of 170,000 Palestinians who got Israeli citizenship and who lived after 1948 in the areas controlled by the State of Israel. Today, they're still about 20% of the population. Well, the Mizrahis, by the way, are the majority among the Jews. So we're talking about a smaller group, and the way they were treated, if I were to describe it generally, take everything I've said about the Mizrahis, make it more extreme, and you basically get how the Palestinians were treated. So for example, let's start with geography. In the first 17 to 19 years, depends on which region you're talking about, Palestinians in Israel were under martial law. They were not allowed to leave their villages or towns without specific permission from a military governor. Almost any organizational activity was forbidden. Of course, economic activity was incredibly limited, as you can imagine. And if anything, Palestinians were mostly able to maybe work for Jewish companies. Also recall that the Palestinian leadership, the intelligentsia, the top politicians, the top religious leaders, they had exited the country in 1948, and the population was left without, again, this is similar to the Mizrahis, without much of its pre-existing organizational infrastructure. If we look about the other subjects, let's go to education, for example. In the education system, the part of it that is intended for the Arabs, first of all, there has to be some distinction because the Arabic part of the population has to be taught in Arabic, so it has to be different schools, etc. But the question is, how is this system run? And the system was run very much under the influence of the security services for many years. And even today, it is still the case that in order to be hired as a teacher, you must have security services approval. So you have to have at least a clean political record. And if you want to be a school manager, then a clean record is not enough. You usually have to have a good record, which is something different. Those of you who may have families or have lived in the Eastern Bloc might know what I'm talking about. Again, if we're talking about underfunding and lack of infrastructure, there are less schools per child for the Palestinian population in Israel than there are for the Mizrahis, and again less than there are for the Ashkenazis. The budgets are smaller. Municipally, the Arabic townships and villages are incredibly underfunded, even compared to Mizrahi settlements. And a very serious problem is, again, the problem of land. In Israel, like you've sort of been able to understand from what I've said so far, almost all of the land is state-owned, except for the land that the Palestinians were able to keep for themselves and approve ownership of in 1948. I'm not going to talk about the composition of land ownership, but even the small percentage of land which Palestinians still control Israel has been trying to take bites out of over the years by land confiscations. So if you have like a small Palestinian town or village and it wants to expand, it will have a score of problems. So first of all, there's little land to expand to because it doesn't own a lot of the land around it already. And even if it does own the land, then the development authorities throw a lot of bureaucratic difficulties in your face, and municipal development plans are not approved or they're not generated by the development authorities at the national and regional levels. And the state often wants to use some of that land, even right next to where Palestinian towns and villages are located, to house more Jews or to construct industrial zones, the income from which goes only to Jewish settlements or to nobody at all. There are also semi-autonomous internal industrial zones in Israel in various places. So if you're living in a Palestinian village, it's very difficult to expand or to develop economically and socially, and they become, of course, overpopulated, overcrowded, and a lot of problems with unemployment, and consequently also crime. This has also been true historically for the Mizrahi communities. As for drugs, I think it's not as much a problem in Israel as it is in some parts of the US, but this has also been an issue. And what else have I not discussed? Oh, of course, the possibility to organize politically. So first of all, Israel, part of its law is a set of British Mandate emergency regulations, which are incredibly draconic, although they're not really enforced. For example, it is illegal for a group of three or more people to convene and criticize a member of cabinet. This is illegal. But this has never been enforced. But a lot of what has been enforced has been used to prevent political organization among Palestinians mostly, whenever it's deemed to be too independent, too nationalist, not enough under the control of the Zionist parties. Because over the years there have been pseudo-parties or fake parties, or at least the parliamentary parties of Palestinians, whose sole intention is to get Palestinians to vote for what are essentially Zionist parties. And even the independent parties which do exist undergo different levels of oppression. And the last 5 years or so, there's been a campaign of political trials against leaderships of Arabic movements and parties, like the Islamic Movement North Branch, and the National Democratic Assembly of Azmi Bshara, and also the Sons of the Country movement, which I won't go into, I won't discuss here. It's very easy to see a lot of parallels between how Palestinians and Mizrahis are treated, and also when it comes to the class composition of Palestinian society, like with the Mizrahim, but to a greater extent, you find a much higher percentage of Palestinians, of course, being a working class other than free tradesmen or capitalists, which are few. And within the working class, they occupy mostly the lower strata and do more menial labor. Although in recent years, we have the phenomenon of migrant workers from the Far East and from Africa, which are actually beginning to form a sort of new underclass. And in a sense, the Mizrahis and the Palestinians are pushed either up or out of the class ladder, if you will, in favor of migrant work. At this point, I think I'm going to stop, and I'm going to sum up by saying that my talk today was more informative than conclusive. I haven't really said what I think or I believe would be a strategy either for Mizrahi Jews or for Palestinians to change the reality in which they live and to transform the society in which they live. And this is something that, of course, all of us, including those of us who are not Mizrahi and not Palestinian, like myself, I am an Ashkenazi Jew, are having to cope with every day, and the more oppressed you are, the more of a burning issue this is to you. But I feel that for you as an audience, getting as many of the facts as possible is the more beneficial thing for me to do as a speaker. I want to thank you all for listening, and now if there are more questions or comments, then this would be a good time.
It's a rhetorical question, so isn't it ironic that you referred to the effort throughout the 19th century of the Ashkenazi Jews striving for equality and equal citizenship. And in fact, that was the core of the thrust of Jewish political activity starting from the Napoleonic Code up until, you could say, and maybe beyond, the Russian Revolution. And here you have this group of people, or some of them, instituting a hierarchical society intent on explicit discriminatory policies, so that the society that they have formed, because quote unquote they couldn't achieve that in Europe, is in fact a kind of mimicking of the oppressive situation that they or their forebears had experienced in Europe. They created their own in what they call the State of Israel. Isn't that ironic?
I would definitely agree that this is ironic, but I also want to add two comments to your own. One is that you have to sort of make the distinction, because like I said, Zionism was a minority position among European Jews even until after the Second World War. For example, my own grandfather and grandmother, after having survived the Holocaust, they'd wanted to go to Australia. And my grandmother even had a visa to go there, but my grandfather couldn't get one, so they ended up in Palestine. And in retrospect, and this is not only ironic, but even, I would say, tragic, my grandfather says that this event was the best thing that ever happened to him, that it was God's will for him to get to Palestine. He, and this is not just something specific to him, but to a whole social stratum or group that he represents, believes that by being favored by God and by suffering aggression from the side of the Palestinians, they reach the conclusion, like I said, that they are the good side, the chosen side, the side that must prevail and must also vanquish the other side, the evil side, the uncultured side, the side that plots against us. And this goes as far sometimes to the level of wishing for mass extermination of Arabs. This has never been expressed politically in any way, organizationally, but I have heard people in my own family and others around me mentioning in different occasions the possibility of mass extermination of Palestinians.
So isn't this extreme maniacal nationalism?
Actually, no, it's not extreme. Because if you think about the relations between European civilization, third world countries, third world people throughout history, you would find that Zionist colonialism is a rather mild form. The total number of Palestinians who have been killed by the Zionist movement over its existence is, I think, less than 30,000, or could be less than 40,000, I'm not sure about the numbers. Which is, it's shocking to say that, but it's relatively small compared to genocides perpetrated by by European powers and by the US against indigenous populations in various places in the world. So it's a mild form of racist nationalism. Unfortunately, there are forms which are much more violent and effective, I might say.
When you spoke about the Palestinian teacher and the principal having to be clean and good, etc., you sort of made a passing comment that referred to Eastern European mentality, and I want you to elaborate on that one thing. The second question is about Zionism. You said that most of the Ashkenazi came from Eastern Europe, but you didn't mention anything about Western Europe and the vast amount of money that supported the expansion of Zionism, and I'd like you to talk about that also.
Okay, about the allusion I made to Eastern Europe, I didn't refer to the mentality, but rather to the situation under some, or perhaps most of the Stalinist governments, in which in order to get into a position of influence, especially in the education system, you had to be in a non-questionable element, a non-negative element, and the state system, the security apparatus, would often, in many Eastern Bloc states, have files on people And if the file said that you were involved in a possibly seditious activity, or even did something, you know, overt that's critical of government policy or some leader or another, then the reaction varied from, in extreme cases, you getting into jail, and in less extreme cases, you not being able to work in certain professions or in certain positions. My own family has a very interesting experience in that respect. My grandfather was a pretty significant activist in the Romanian Communist Party, but I won't go into all of the details of the motivation I have for making this comment. The other question that was raised about the role of West European Jewry, then yes, it's very true that if you look at the Zionist movement as composed of people and of capital, then the capital came mostly from Western Europe and from US Jews. A very influential initial capitalist who supported the Zionist colonialism in Palestine was the Baron de Rothschild, who was involved in banking and other sorts of activity in France and other countries, and was very wealthy, and he funded a lot of the agricultural projects before the turn of the 20th century. And other capitalists also began to be involved over time, especially, like I said, from Western Europe and the US. Actually, I would say that for most of them, it eventually was a profitable activity. It wasn't just philanthropy, and the effort was that either in the short term or the long term, investment in the Zionist project would also get you financial benefit. And as we see today, or in recent decades, this has certainly proved to be true for important Jewish capitalists in Israel and elsewhere.
Hi, so I was kind of unclear about the timeline of the education system that you were talking about. And I was just curious, I'm also a teacher, and many of the schools in the United States are segregated because of the fact that schools are set up for students to go where they live. And our cities are segregated cities. So I was wondering about how that works out, who goes to school where, and if it is actually different curriculums and in different languages and how people negotiate that, because you also said not too many people still speak Arabic or their other original language. So I was just wondering, time, how school systems set up, segregation.
Okay, first, regarding original languages, these are, on the whole, not taught in the education system. First of all, you would never have classes in Moroccan or Yemenite. And as for Arabic, some schools have classes in Arabic, but to a very little extent, and this is geared towards use in the intelligence corps. So you study more written Arabic rather than spoken Arabic, and you learn to say things like, the Minister of Defense held a conference regarding the purchase of new warships and stuff like that. So that's the sort of vocabulary that is in focus when Arabic is taught. And this certainly doesn't get you to the level of speaking Arabic as a second language. And very quickly the situation was that effectively Mizrahi Jews were their children at least, were no longer Arabic-speaking people. And also it's very important to note with respect to Arabic that the spoken language and the written language differ considerably. As for the timeline of setting up segregation, the setup of the school system was indeed very powerfully segregated, and the level of segregation has decreased over time. Well, segregation is not officially mandated, and it was never officially mandated to begin with. But if you have people that live in different neighborhoods and the registration for schools is limited according to which neighborhood you live in, then there's effective segregation. And so you have certain schools which are considered to be, they're called professional rather than theoretical high schools, for example. So in the professional high schools, sometimes they would only get up to a certain grade, like only the 10th or the 9th. And their curriculum would involve like metalwork and other low-paying professional skills. While in the theoretical high schools, you would study mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, etc. And like I said, over time, the level of segregation has decreased. It has even decreased with respect to Palestinians. For example, the martial law was lifted after a while. Although still, segregation is very effective, especially on the municipal level.
You've talked about the deculturation of quote-unquote Arab Jews or Mizrahi, and it's a remarkable thing. And the way I hear it is that Mizrahi tend to be more socially conservative than Ashkenazic Jews, also that they tend to be more politically conservative, that the Likud and the other sort of right-wing parties have been very successful at recruiting among them. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but what I wanted to ask you is, why has the deculturation of Mizrahi been so successful? Why has it worked to the extent that it has, in spite of the fact that they don't seem to get a lot out of the system?
Well, I'll begin with the first question about conservatism. First of all, in Israeli politics, you can't really talk about conservation. This is a new state. There's nothing to conserve. And also, thinking of the Likud as, say, a right-wing party, as opposed to the supposedly left-wing party, which is Labor or Mapai, which I mentioned. By the way, it's two names for the same party. They've changed name. Is not really the right way to look at things. And the question of what a party signifies to its voters is something that is quite different from what its policies eventually are. This is true in general, but this is especially true in Israel. The Likud leadership, at least in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, until it came to power in 1977, represented to the Mizrahis mostly one thing, and that is the rejection of the dominance of the Ashkenazis, of Mapai-style organization, of Histadrut control of workplaces and of social activity and cultural activity, of the continued deterioration of their neighborhoods. They were made a lot of promises. They were made to feel by the Likud leadership, which of course was Ashkenazi, that they are not looked down upon. They're not inferior. They are especially respected as fellow participants in the war for survival against the Arabs. All Jews have shed blood to defend their country and their state, etc. And this was very effective. Similar rhetoric has also been effective for the Shas party, which technically it's a party which represents an ultra-religiosity, which traditionally the Mizrahis were not known for. Actually, the fact is that East European Jewry historically was more religious on the average than Jewry in Arab countries. And also, you could say, in a sense, even less advanced technologically. For example, in the 1920s and 30s, many Arabic Jews in Iraq had electricity in their houses and had private automobiles, while the Ashkenazi Jews still lived in semi-feudal hamlets in rural Russia. So the question of who exactly is conservative, what is conserved, and what is the meaning of Mizrahi support for different political parties is a very complex one. And what they feel or what they believe or have been led to believe that they would get out of certain parties being dominant is also something that has changed over the course of Israeli history and is very difficult from what these parties eventually do when they do get to power.
You've heard about what they call the Israel lobby and the alliance that they made with neocon in this country. And you also talked about this ideology of us versus them, etc. And we're seeing some of that over here. Do you believe that there is a link here, that this was some sort of an imported ideology, or that this is something that was more domestic, more created over here?
Not only is there a link, I believe that this is a wider phenomenon, and the rhetoric that we hear in the last 5 or 6 years in the U.S. regarding radical Islam or states such as Iran, North Korea, Syria, Iraq, etc., is to me reminiscent not only of what I hear in Israel about the Arabs, but what Europeans or European countries, or rather European states and ruling classes, have been telling themselves and telling their populations about countries that they colonize and exploit for many centuries. And this is just, in my opinion, variations on the same theme. With regards to the Israeli lobby in the US, then it's a very hard question to answer. To what extent are US-Israel relations driven more by US interests, economic and geopolitical, and to what extent are they the result of the influence of a Jewish lobby? I believe, although I really don't have that much hard facts to base it on, that it's more about U.S. interests and that the senior partner in this relationship is the one whose interests predominate in setting out a policy. And the situation sometimes reaches the extreme in which Israel might make a certain specific decision, even technical military decision, like whether to withdraw a certain amount of troops from Gaza after they've been inserted for a campaign. And this is a specific example which occurred, I think, in 2004 or 2005, in which you would hear an Israeli high-ranking officer saying that we're going to be staying in Gaza for X additional days. But somebody in the U.S. calls Sharon up and tells him, look, we want to pull out now, and then the decision just changes. I do believe that the U.S. has almost veto power, not that it exercises it all the time, and that it directs policy to such a level of detail all the time, but it does have the capacity, if not always the will, to stop Israel from doing one thing or another, or to direct it to some course of action or another.
Well, I'm really interested in where you fit into all this. It must be really very awkward for you, even to speak in this country, let alone in Israel. I mean, you are very progressive in your opinions, and drawn an Ashkenazi Jew, you are belonging to the group which are the oppressors in Palestine, and yet you speak out very courageously against that. And I admire what you're doing. It takes courage.
I suppose some of it does take courage, but a mitigating factor is the fact that beyond a certain level of being progressive or radical, you're no longer perceived as a danger. Because if your opinion is in the minority that is small enough, and the political establishment doesn't think that it's feasible for opinions like yours to get acceptance anytime soon, then you're allowed to voice them almost with impunity. And this is true not only for the establishment, but sometimes the demonstrations, the people that right-wingers try to beat up are not people like me with the more radical posters, but rather, say, left-wing Zionists from the Meretz variety, if that means anything to you, who only hold up posters saying negotiations with the Palestinian Authority now, or get out of the 1967 territories now, which are very specific minor demands that are often even voiced as a way of sustaining and defending the existence of the Israeli system. But they're the ones who often would get attacked because they're considered to be an actual political threat to the way things are run right now. So at least for the time being, I sort of get a reprieve. Plus, I'm very privileged for being neither a Mizrahi, especially not a Palestinian. For a Palestinian to have such positions, and especially if he were to act on them, means risking arrests, beatings, shunning from all sorts of frameworks, meaning being in conflict with elements within his own family, his own village or town, which might be telling him, look, don't rock the boat. We might not like the way things are, but what you're trying to do is only going to cause us more trouble. It's going to bring problems into focus. It's going to deepen the level of repression that we're suffering already. So enough with your utopian radicalism.
That said, are there groups within Israel that have access to more privilege to make alliances, to act as allies for groups that might not have the privilege or opportunity to speak out?
Overall, I would like to say no, but the answer is not exactly no. One of the problems is that the actions that you do see on the part of people from more privileged background is either focused on humanitarian relief, or if it is actually political, they often support very mildly reformist positions, which I often believe are completely untenable. For example, the two-state solution. And by working to promote these mildly reformist modifications of the current situation, in many ways they are also reinforcing it. So this is a very frustrating experience for me.
I think the inescapable analogy here, in a way, is between the situation in the United States, let's say in the South, where you have underprivileged, poverty-stricken white people who are kept apart from the black people and told that the black people are their enemy and so forth, and are sort of turned against people who ought to be in a class sense their natural allies. And with that in mind, I wonder, how do you talk? How do you or somebody with your views as an activist talk to people of a Mizrahi background who are culturally not the same as you? How do you talk to them about their relationship with Palestinians?
unless I'm talking to someone who's a political activist with a very high level of consciousness and self-consciousness, then you can't really bring up in these terms the question of one person's relationship as a member of an ethnic group to the way it relates to different ethnic groups, because, well, actually, the way I would like to answer this question is to say that it's exactly, or not exactly, it's very similar to problems you might have talking to poor southern white workers about theirs and your relationship to the black population. It's usually not only impossible to bring this up as a subject for discussion, usually the terms in which most people think of themselves and of the groups that they're in, if they at all think about them as groups, are very different than what we think, that the terms we think in, and incorporate a lot of what the economic and political establishment would like us to think and to say and to believe. And that makes conversation very difficult. So unless you're talking about a very specific issue that you or someone else are facing in your day-to-day lives, the possibility for you to expand the scope and discuss the inter-ethnic relationship in a critical way is almost non-existent.
Any more questions?
In recent weeks, refugees from Darfur arrived at the border of Israel, and there was a decision, I guess, from the government not to accept them, and sort of surprised a lot of people. But is there something within Israel, in the press, in the government, in statements that were made that you think led refugees from Darfur to believe that they would be accepted in Israel?
I can't really say for sure, although in retrospect, there's been a lot of opposition almost across the political spectrum to the expelling of Darfur refugees from Israel, even from, like I said, very right-wing politicians. And the claim that is made is that Israel, as a state which has high moral standards, supposedly cannot allow itself to turn away refugees, and certainly people like the Jewish people who have survived the Holocaust cannot put people in risk of being returned to where they might be ethnically cleansed, which is a nicer word for being murdered. So I guess you could say if a person from Darfur was somehow well-versed in Israeli politics or Israeli public opinion, he could have expected this sort of opposition to expelling him. But really, I would think they didn't make these sorts of considerations and just tried to go wherever they could move to. Because I understand that in Egypt, they're treated not at all well, and they're often returned back to the Darfur region from where they came. So if you're a Darfurian, and you've gone to Egypt, and you want to avoid being caught and returned or otherwise maltreated, then why not try to go into Israel? And another reason which might motivate people to come is the fact that Israel has so many migrant workers, not only from Asia, but also from Africa, from places like Nigeria and Kenya and elsewhere in the continent. So if there's already a community of Africans, and not so small, living in Israel, why not another number of them?
So the government of Israel didn't actually take an active part in the Save Darfur campaign in trying to convince people that there should be some intervention in Sudan?
It certainly did not suggest that it would be willing to take in refugees from Darfur. That certainly did not happen. As to whether it had minor involvement in the campaign for Darfur, it's possible, though I haven't been following that closely enough to be able to say.